Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That is the voice of our dearly departed founder and leader, Mr. Brian Brown. You're listening to The Brown Briefly on the Voice of Vachon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vachon Island, Washington, and on voiceofvachon.org. It is Tuesday, June 30th, 2020, in the year of the tweet. Lovely. And the global pandemic. And so much more. With us this morning and sanitized with me in the Gene Bosch studio in bustling and bodacious downtown Vachon, while the rest of our team lounges comfortably at home in their whatevers, is VOV's original Zoomologist, former jet pilot, no tech scares me, mood modulating sound engineer, Truman O'Brien. Welcome, Truman.
Thank you. Wow, this is getting more exciting every time. No tech. What was that?
No tech scares me.
Oh, boy, that's good. Yeah, well.
Especially with your new role as Voice of Vachon's technology leader.
Yeah. Just took that job on.
Taking a page from Click and Clack.
Exactly. The Tapper Brothers. Yeah, there you go.
Right. Out of the land of magnolias and settled here on the island of Madrones is our analytic, academic, social worker, poet, backup singer, and former all-star shortstop for the Dixie Debutantes, languishing in her palace on Vachon shores, is Lynn Carrigan, woman of insight and sight. Welcome, Lynn.
Good morning. And I must tell you all that I am wearing pants, but only for one reason, which is that they are now saying, you know, you shouldn't, in this era of COVID, walk around your house barefoot.
Oh.
So I am applying that equally to my nether regions.
Okay, so now this is going to require the rest of our panel to admit whether they are or are not.
Are not wearing pants. Yeah.
That's right.
So if I'm out in the garden...
with no pants?
Songs clothing, if as long as I still wear my shoes, I'm okay.
Yes,
presumably, yes. that would be
That's what I heard. Yeah,
something that someone might use a drone to examine. But highly visible on our Zoom screen this morning is the phantom editor of Indivisible Vachon's weekly online newsletter for your consideration. He is Kevin Jones. Kevin, how many aides do you have helping you keep tabs on the tweeter in chief's latest escapades?
Wow, you know, it's been interesting because we started out with a preference for limeade and then lemonade, but now it's sort of shifting to orangeade. So you know, we've got a pretty good crew of aides helping us out with that.
Hmm.
And I am wearing pants.
And you are wearing pants, okay?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I saw a post the other day that said, you know, I'm wearing pants, not because they're comfortable, because it protects you. Wear the mask.
Exactly.
All right. We must keep laughing. Bruce Hallman is our steadfast guardian of the galaxy. Let me say that again. Bruce Hallman is our steadfast guardian of the galaxy who, as an historian, attempts to provide a long-range view and continually reminds us that while the grinding wheels of justice...
I can't get it.
They may take time, but they eventually get the bastards in the end. How is that view from the long range looking this week, Bruce?
Well, it's looking pretty good, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit later, but the Supreme Court, three pretty significant decisions this week, and I mean, I was just reflecting when I was reading through the script, in 1896, the Supreme Court ruled in Plessy versus Ferguson that separate but equal was acceptable in the United States. You know, it took almost 60 years until 1953 in Brown versus the Board of Education that totally reversed that decision and says separate but equal is inherently unequal. And that's within one person's lifetime. So, yeah, I mean, we get frustrated at times, but right now, I think what we're seeing, and particularly from Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, is Chief Justice Roberts, is the attempt to make sure that there is a balance between the three branches of government. We don't see that very significantly with the Republican leadership in the Senate, who seem to have rolled over and gone silent. But from the Democrats in the House and the Senate, and from the Supreme Court, the clear sort of message that this is a government of balanced powers, not a kleptocracy in the form of a president. So I'm very encouraged.
Good news.
I was
good
really
news.
Heartened by that because of the press, I think, that our president has been trying to convince us all that the courts could and should be partisan if they are appointed by a particular administration. And I'll tell you that those three reasoned and fairly liberal and thoughtful decisions to me proved that the justices may not think the way the administration thinks. I love that.
We can hope. And I do want to confirm that separate but equal ruling applied to race, not gender.
Yeah, okay. Definitely. And yet what we've seen, you know, in the last 15 years is movement to acceptance of gay rights, LGBTQ rights, transgender rights. Still being fought. But again, within a period of less than 100 years, some pretty significant changes.
Well, heck, the ERA just got ratified by all 50 states and is yet to be confirmed by Congress. So, yeah, they do grind slowly.
They do.
Joining
what
us
did you
off
just the, say the ERA is now ratified by all 50 states?
It's been ratified by all 50 states, but Congress has to confirm it somehow. And maybe Bruce can give us more insight on that.
Has that been flying under the radar and I missed it? Because I knew there were only, two or three states left to ratify it before it could go to Congress. When did that happen?
Well, our Zoomologist is going to look that up to get us the details here. But let us not forget that we still have one more person joining us off the bench from his self-distancing semi-retirement is singer, thespian, landscape architect, half a bubble short of plum carpenter, Michael Shook, a.k.a. Chauncey Gardner. Michael, can you drop some words of comfort on us today?
I can. It's a beautiful day, for starters. I mean, that in itself is marvelous, of course. I have a species rhododendron called R. glandulifrum that blooms in August and September. And this year, I think it looks like it's set flower buds. So it may be blooming. I have to wait and see, just like the slow grinding wheels of justice. Species rhododendrons are often very slow to bloom. So I'm very excited about this because it's a beautiful white flower, if it blooms, and it's scented. So that's
a scented rhododendron. Wow!
Yeah.
Wow.
So I have to throw a downer in here. To my deep dismay, the fools who run Major League Baseball have decided that the National League now must be afflicted with the designated hitter,
really?
Which is.
I miss that.
This is an abomination. The rules clearly state 9 players on a side. And it's not just that there's a 10th player added that's not okay by the rules. It's that it upsets the whole beautiful geometry of 9 players, 9 innings, 3 strikes, you're out, 3 outs in an inning.
3 bases.
Just, the whole thing is, it's chaos now.
Just matches the rest of the country.
Evidently, this is what's happening.
Everything is being thrown up and reconsidered.
it's not what it used to be, Michael, and it never really ever was.
Those are your words of comfort. Change is the only constant.
That's right.
But it's so true that, you know, what you just said, Bruce. I mean, you know, one of the first members of the Hall of Fame in that first class, everyone knows the name Ty Cobb. The man went into the stands from the field one time and attacked a black person in the stands that he didn't set him off somehow. You know, it's never what you think it is.
Wow. And nobody said anything?
Pardon?
No one stopped him? No one said anything?
Boy, not in those days. It was about 1910, 1912 or something. Wow. And he wasn't even suspended.
I would suspect in some circles he was applauded.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I am Susan McCabe, and I'm here to fill this seat while I prepare to host my Real Talk show in 15 minutes after the Briefly team fires me up. So let's start with this week's blatant and bald-faced untruths from the White House. Briefed or not briefed about Russian bounties on American soldiers in Afghanistan? What do we have to say about that? Do you think he knew?
Anyone? It doesn't matter whether he knew or not. I mean, what matters is that he should have known because his staff knew, you know, the intelligence agencies knew, the military knew, and the fact that he didn't act or the fact that he didn't know, which is even more damning than if he didn't act, it's treason, and it just needs to be treated that way. It's just reprehensible behavior.
Kevin.
You're muted, Kevin. You're muted, Kevin.
Unmute. Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I totally agree, Bruce, with what you said. The other comment that I heard, which I thought was interesting, is that in this business of briefing the president on issues of national importance and the daily briefing, the longstanding principle is once that document has been dropped on the president's desk, the president has been briefed. Whether the president actually chooses to open the document and read it is not the intelligence community's fault. It's the president's fault. So it's more craziness.
To me, there were two questions in that whole article and the reportage of it, because it sounded as if, let us take Trump at his word. That he didn't know, he wasn't told, because I've heard that other level of analysis about why wasn't he told? So if he wasn't told, who chose not to tell him? And I heard an interview with somebody that I don't remember that was talking about, you know, the kind of vetting process that has to be used in terms of what goes into that presidential brief. And that there was an argument about whether the upper echelons of his administration thought that the report was true or not. And the concern that I really had about hearing that interview was that there was no facts to back up the person who blocked the president from being told if he wasn't told. They just said, I don't believe that's true. And there's some technical evidence that it wasn't. And that was all that was said. Okay. And so I feel like, A, we're not getting any information about how they make those decisions. And B, how would you know what was true and what was not true in this administration?
Michael.
And this is classic. They're the upper echelon. If that is what's happening, Lynn, if the scenario you just laid out is happening in that way, it's just classic stonewalling. I find it exceedingly difficult to believe that our intelligence community would have come to the conclusions that they did casually or on some circumstantial evidence. If the circumstantial evidence was there, then they probably went and delved deeper and did everything they could to try to confirm it, because that's a really serious serious thing that's going on there.
Absolutely.
And Trump has made it very clear from the outset of his administration, he doesn't read briefings. He doesn't, he said a number of times early on, I don't need them. I'm a stable genius. I'm smarter than all the generals. He's made it very clear. He doesn't like to have to read these things. My guess is he just doesn't bother.
Yeah.
You know, I will throw out one thing. In many real estate, big time developers and all of this stuff, I've met several, and they like one pagers, a one page brief, whatever it is. I don't care what it has to do with. They want one page, and, you know, not even single spaced. I mean, they want it brief, you know? And I think that was the background that, that Trump came from, obviously. And so, you know, I mean, that's the way they did business for years and years and years.
Yeah,
so
but he's not a real estate developer anymore.
Trust me, I know this. And I agree 100%. I'm just saying, and I'm not making that as an excuse. I'm just saying that that's where that came from, that mentality. Kevin.
You know, and it kind of reminds me, Truman, I've thought this a few times, is let's run the country like a country and not run the country like a country.
Exactly.
Good idea.
But I also would like to comment on this notion of what Lynn brought up is, you know, is there conflicting data, et cetera? And, you know, in fact, you know, this intelligence system that we have works on lots and lots of different levels, right? There's stuff that you pick up by human contact. There's things that you pick up electronically. There's things you might pick up by other measures. So, you know, there's all kinds of data coming into our intelligence network, and it is not always consistent, right? So you can probably every time say, well, there's some ambiguity, but you know what? It seems like the question then in that case is, when do we decide to give a country a pass? And this is Russia. Claim, and the claim is that they're paying a foreign nation to kill American service people. And that's just not really the time, I think, to give a pass, right? That's the time
you think?
Say, you know, even if we're wrong, I should at least raise the issue and suggest that's a bad policy on the part of Russia. And there doesn't seem to be any evidence that that happened. It seems to be just denials and confusion about whether anybody really knew what was going on, which sometimes you don't know what's going on. Ambiguity is a reality, and our leaders are faced with ambiguity and have to make good decisions nonetheless. This is not the kind of good decision you'd make in the face of ambiguity.
I agree. Well said.
I will throw out.
And also important to remember, I mean, it's a breach of international law. You know, hiring mercenaries and giving bounties on killing, you know, combatants is a breach of international law. So it's much more significant than just, you know, a bad policy.
Does it go as far as being an act of war? Do you know?
Good question.
Yeah, I mean, that's act of war is a very difficult one to sort of pin down. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly you could interpret it that way. I mean, is
not
it,
that we would want level, to, but
that the level of the attack on Pearl Harbor, you know, yeah,
I mean, got
yeah,
it. Okay,
but yeah.
Kevin, I do want to throw out one thing about the intelligence network. One of the things that one of the processes that they've been going through in the last, no, I don't know, it's probably been the last 20 years now, but it's a consolidation of intelligence. And they're consolidating a whole bunch of different inputs into a single entity. I was involved in the military and in military intelligence, and I know that's an oxymoron, but they, but the things that we used to do, I've talked to some of the people that are involved in that same area, and it's completely changed. Now it's a much more integrated system. So the reports that they're getting are pretty well integrated in, you know, they're getting one voice really.
So are you saying that the ambiguity is somewhat reduced?
Yes, absolutely it is. Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
You're probably referring to the Director of National Intelligence, which was a position created after 9/11.
Right.
to help integrate the resources of the intelligence community so they weren't siloed, I'm assuming is what you're referring to.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any more comments on that situation, folks? Or shall we go to something a little brighter, the current Supreme Court decisions to which we alluded during our introduction? Let's see, in the past week or two, they made three decisions for humans, one on the maintenance of abortion clinics in Louisiana, another on LGBTQ rights in the workplace, a big one for dreamers in maintaining the DACA law for immigrants born in the U.S. And I noticed this sneaky one for corporations with the ruling that the president can fire the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And it is a bit ironic because when Biden wins the Oval Office, he can fire Trump's appointee from the post if indeed that person doesn't do a whole lot of damage before the new president is inaugurated. So what do you all have to say about these Supreme Court decisions? Pick one.
Yay.
Yay. Yay is good. You know, why do you think this is happening? We discussed it a little earlier that perhaps the justices are recognizing that they are a separate body from the executive branch. And do they have any reason to cover their tails, or could this actually be just good judgment?
Well, I think, from my perspective, I mean, there's a couple things going on. I mean, it's one, Chief Justice is really, Roberts is very intent on sort of maintaining the independence of the court. He's conservative, but he's not a right-wing wingnut kind of conservative. And he's always been very intent on sort of having the Supreme Court play the constitutional role that's defined for it. And so that's very encouraging. And the other thing to me that's very encouraging, particularly in the Louisiana case, it's a matter of interpretation, but what he did, but he basically ruled that a past decision of the Supreme Court should be upheld, even though in the original case 3 years ago, he was on, he ruled against it, and this time he ruled for it because the majority had ruled in favor 3 years ago. That gives me great hope for Roe versus Wade, that as that comes up, that to potentially the Supreme Court's going to use that sense, and I can't remember the legal term, I say die or something like that, that past decisions should stand. And so it's encouraging.
Bruce, can you speak to this? Because I heard and actually saw Roberts on TV say this, that he felt that his ruling was a very kind of narrow technicality ruling, and that he did not mean it to be a broad and sweeping kind of condemnation. He didn't say too much about it, but he basically left the door open for another challenge to come forward. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think there'll be challenges, but what it means to me, at least, is he's sort of staking out the fact that past Supreme Court decisions should not be overturned lightly,
right?
Without serious sort of constitutional questions being brought forward. So something like Roe versus Wade, certainly could be overturned, but my sense is what you're seeing from him, at least, is a sense that those past decisions should be maintained. You don't know for certain.
Kevin,
but I'm encouraged.
And what I think I heard, there are three rulings here. And Bruce, I recall hearing the same commentary about the Louisiana abortion clinic, that, we're going to preserve the position that the court has taken. But Lynn, to your point, I think on the LGBTQ and the Dreamers, I think there I heard a commentary that was more, it was just sloppy work. So,
right,
if you come back with a good argument, we'll reconsider. I don't know that means by default that they're going to change the ruling. But anyway, that's what I recall hearing. And I don't know if other people heard maybe different attributes around that.
I think you're right that I was interested in the fact that in both of those cases, that, you know, you brought up the earlier one, that they are giving kind of counsel a little bit about why they made the decision they did, or kind of how the process works and what they focus on. So, I don't know. I cringe every time I hear that implication that, you know, you can easily refile. And yet, on the other hand, I'm grateful to hear the basis on which they are making their decisions, because I think it's so instructive.
Mm-hmm. Instructive.
So, Bruce, I have a question. You know, you mentioned this attribute of, you know, staying with the court's decisions, mm-hmm. As a matter of practice or principle or history or whatever. So what would be, do we know what would be the conditions under which a ruling would be overturned? Does there need to be new evidence, new law, new, what would change it? Or is our perception that, you know, once the court rules and ad infinitum, it never changes?
No. I mean, Supreme Court rulings change, you know, I mean, Brown versus the Board of Education, Plessy versus Ferguson, sort of the classic example, where the court reflects the changing mores and the changing values of a society. You know, I mean, the court, the Constitution and the law is not a fixed thing. You know, I mean, some sort of originalist attorneys and judges want to say, well, the language is immutable. But in the past, in American, at least jurisprudence, you know, the law is always interpretable. The law, it changes as society changes. And I mean, we do have a living constitution, despite the fact that some conservatives would want to say that it's not a changeable, interpretable document, that it's just a fixed thing. But it's not. And so, yeah, we're going to see shifts. We're going to see changes. You know, I think what impressed me about Robert's statement was not that it's not changeable, but that unless there's overwhelming sort of reasons to change it, you know, that we're going to stick with past decisions. And you know, again, that leaves anything like Roe versus Wade, it leaves it potentially open to being changed. But the reasons are going to have to be fairly substantial. It's not that the court will lightly change past decisions.
And regarding Roe versus Wade, my understanding of the polling across the country is that the mores, while they are fairly intense in the you know, extreme religious right and the evangelicals, that the general population's percentage of people who support the existing Roe versus Wade law has not changed very much, that the country still broadly supports a woman's right to choose what to do with her own body.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, when it comes to an issue like Roe v. Wade, it's really still in front of the Supreme Court, one must make a good argument in order to either sustain precedent or strengthen the law. It's still about making a good argument, because the Supreme Court is not polling American citizens.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And Bruce, think, correct me if I'm wrong.
That's
but,
really, and
oh, go ahead. Go
that's
ahead, Michael.
Key, Susan. Brett Kavanaugh wrote some months ago a 16-page report, I guess you would say, about just this precedent, and when is it appropriate for the court to consider overturning precedent? And Brown v. Board of Education is one that he summoned up, which was most people on the liberal side of the spectrum consider that a great victory. He was using it in terms of the, as you said, the mores, the ethics of the country had changed. People had come to see that was not appropriate. So the court in that context overturned it. And I think what you're saying, Susan, is really crucial. If there's a case brought that directly challenges Roe v. Wade, an essay that I was reading recently said the folks who support a woman's right to control her own body and her own life, literally, need to go into the court and make a very, very strong argument for that, not just relying on a precedent or something else. It's just go in with both guns blazing, so to speak. That's a terrible analogy. Sorry. in this country, it's a terrible analogy.
But you know, that's what opponents are going to
come in there
with.
Yeah. And really make that argument on constitutional grounds. Mm-hmm. As a woman, do I have the right to make my own decisions about my body? And that, to me, is where that fundamentally rests.
And of
course, that's the argument. I'm going to leap in as a feminist, you know, scholar over long periods of time. Where that argument has been stuck for many, many years, that the left tends to use that argument about that it's an issue of choice and a woman's right to choose, as opposed to the argument on the other side, which is it's murder, cut and dried, no matter what, and they don't want to see it. So it's two different arguments that have very little connection to each other, and that I think the people in the middle having to choose have to pick how they're going to respond.
And of course, the whole argument over the mask, the wearing of the mask, is that same argument. And it's those folks who are arguing against Roe v. Wade are the same people who are arguing, saying, you can't tell me what to do with my body with a mask. Oh, well,
Maybe we could bring that up at some point.
Missing each other.
Exactly.
You know, there's an easy, I don't know if I should get into this, but I actually said this to a person. I was having a reasoned discussion with someone who was a very devout person against abortion. And I said, well, I asked this person, did you support the war in Iraq that had just been fought? And he said, well, yes, you know, we had to do that. And I said, well, do you suppose, I laid out the scenario, there were people there who were killed, undoubtedly, who were pregnant women and infants died in the storm of shells and cannon shells and everything else, the bombardment. This is what happens in war. And he said, well, yeah, it's unavoidable in war. And I said, so you're actually not against taking innocent life. It's just who's going to make that choice. In this case, it was President Bush who made the choice, George W. But when it comes to an individual woman making that decision, you're against that. But you can't stand there and tell me that you're against the taking of innocent life if you support really virtually any war. It just, it's, you can't do it.
Or the death penalty. Same thing. Who chooses who dies and who lives? Mm-hmm. It's a slippery slope.
And it's, you know, any of these arguments that go up to the Supreme Court are kind of fraught to me between the emotional uprising that's happening and the logic behind the arguments. So I think that, you know, we are flawed individuals, and sometimes we confuse our emotional arguments with the logic of the, ways of thinking in other perspectives. It always astounds me to watch the process of the law and see how many different versions of truth there are. You know, whether it's a personal truth, an individual truth, versus some kind of absolute truth based on what a broader cultural agreement. You know, it's fascinating. And you know, I watch even the Black Lives Matter movement, and I'll take a risky step here as well to say, for me, I watch the turn from the right to speak out against this horrific atrocity of murder through all of the, you know, history that we've had since blacks have been emancipated, all of those atrocities need to be spoken out against, in my opinion, and we need to include blacks in our justice system way better than we ever have. But when they moved into CHOP and sort of said, then we will take over a section of the county, of the city, and kind of regulate our own lives from there and until, you know, our demands have been met, you kind of move into a different argument about now whose rights are we talking about, and how do you go from, you know, the community values there in that particular neighborhood with the arguments that the occupiers have. And it's just astounding and very interesting to me to see how the arguments shift and change and expand.
Thank you, Lynn, for bringing that up. I'd like us all to take a look at that particular issue, the CHOP, which is has experienced now, I believe, three shootings, fatal shootings, and several weeks of relative peace before that. So, folks, if you were Mayor Jenny Durkan, what would you be doing with the CHOP right now? What do you think is the best move?
I am so glad I am not mayor of anything right now. Yeah. That's just the first thing that pops into my head. Just, oh my gosh. I think I would be working really, really hard to communicate with the folks who are in charge there of CHOP. If
anyone is in charge,
consistently in charge. And stress, you know, finding a way to move the thing forward so that it can be moved apart over a period of days.
I agree, Michael. I think that she better be doing some very rapid negotiation and maybe breaking down some of the demands and the legitimate points into short-term and long-term objectives, because I think it cannot end well if anybody tries to take over a section of a country or a city unlawfully. And I think it just is going to draw unwanted federal scrutiny and unwanted federal interventions. If we cannot, and it's already drawn lawsuits from the business people, you know, in that community saying, now wait, our rights are being trampled here now. So for me, I'd be saying I would look for some negotiation and some separation of some of those demands into, and then make some agreement of what we can do right now to improve the law and the processes for African Americans and other blacks, which I think is really necessary. But some of what they say is very long term, and I don't mean to say put it off, but I'm saying you can't solve everything in, you know, 2 days.
Well, I think her challenge right now is multifaceted, but it is the CHOP was intended originally as a strong statement, and I think they've made their statement. Right. I was down there. I visited it before the shootings, and it was a very peaceful, very egalitarian statement of how some people would like the world to be in a very beautiful way, with free food, free healthcare, free clothing, and all that sort of stuff. And they have shut down the police precinct there. So it seems to me Mayor Durkan's challenge is to find a way to allow the statement, which I think she has tried very hard to do. They've really been supportive. There are blocks up there to prevent crazy people from driving into it. But now the security is thinning. And her other challenge is to protect people and to return the rights to the local businesses. It's a messy, messy situation.
Anytime you have a shooting and the people there do not allow the police to come in to deal with that, that is dead wrong. I don't care. There's no justification for that at all in my mind. I get really upset when I see that. I mean, here, you are trampling all over the rights of the people who live there, who have their businesses there, who's invested their money and time and effort into building that place. And you're letting a bunch of idiots come in there and shut that down. Absolutely unacceptable. Sorry.
And it's,
I just cannot buy it at any.
And what I, what I heard on the radio was that they might've been able to save the one person's life,
yeah,
but they could not get help to him. And that's
they
a
being the
tragedy.
Police.
It kind of comes
the police
back
or
to
their EMTs. Or
are we going to be a nation of laws
or anarchists,
a nation of people? I mean, we have, that's that bargain that we made. I totally agree with you, Lynn, that the injustices that have been heaped upon certain people, when you've got your back, like I said last week, pressed against the wall for so many years, so hard, you're bound to have that blow up in your face. And I think that's what's happened. But at the same time, Truman, I think you're right on the money there. There's got to be that a rule of law there. We descend into utter chaos.
Well, you know, they made their point. They had their voice. They were allowed their voice to be heard. They did a fine job of that. But you don't destroy property. You don't, you know, you
kill
don't
people.
Kill people. You don't, you know, break the rule of law. I mean, it's just real clear to me. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's really, there's so much we see, but so much we probably don't know. In other words, there are certainly organizers for the CHOP. I couldn't tell you who they are, but they are continuing to want to press their point. The centuries of oppression lead you to say, how do we get out of this? And the systems that are through the normal channels have not been working as expeditiously. If you listen to Representative Clayton in South Carolina, I believe, he said, if you were in the country in 1964, you can't tell me things aren't better. And his point was that, yes, governments do make change. They don't make change rapidly. But now, of course, we have a group of people who want to see change made, and they want to see it really rapid. And they don't want to lose this opportunity, right, to see change occur. And so how do you persist is, I think, you have to be disruptive. So in my mind, that's a logical progression, right? We want to see change. We don't want to give up the opportunity. We're going to continue to be disruptive. So what does the mayor do? Well, the mayor should certainly try to avoid people getting killed. So, you know, the SUV that drove around on the field, you know, maybe that just means you need another set of blockades to keep people from coming in. This is the second time, at least, that a car and people with a gun in the car have been involved in the CHOP that we've heard about in the news. Is that, I think, the preferred answer, is to support the continuance of the CHOP? I don't think that's the objective, but I think it's, how do we get public safety into this situation? On the other hand, it seems like expeditious progress is needed, and it can be difficult because the organizers may not have come to agreement on what they want.
Well, and we only have 1 minute left, but I do think that I do think we can make some expeditious process on policing. The idea of systemic racism in the country is going to take a lot longer, and that's where the real anger is bubbling up from. I mean,
I think if the mayor shows some progress on those things, but I think you have to, you know, have that discussion with the organizers, like you said earlier, Susan, is to say, you know, here's the things we are going to do. So let's
your they voice need to know they've been heard.
Let's move in this direction. Let's put a timeline on this thing and let's move forward. She may be doing that.
And I believe I hear the Harbor Lights now. Thank you all for listening. This has been The Brown Briefly, here every Tuesday at 11 a.m.
Good night.
Thank you, team.
Bye.